I enjoyed your book very much, Shirley. It's called Blush, A Mennonite Girl Meets a Glittering World. You know, the Mennonite culture, I was just wondering, you know, a lot of people I think in this area know about the Amish, maybe less about Mennonites. Can you tell us about the difference?
Sure. Both the Amish and the Mennonites have the same historical root structure. They go back to the 16th century to a group that has been called by historians the Radical Reformation. And they were called this because they were dissenters from the dissenters. And they were first called Anabaptists because they both refused to baptize their own children as babies, and they rebaptized adults upon confession of faith, believing this was the more biblical practice. And the reason that this was deemed to be a radical act was that the church and state were totally united, whether it was a Catholic kingdom or a Protestant kingdom, and by refusing to baptize infants, the reformers, the Anabaptist reformers, were actually withdrawing from the state system itself. And this wasn't deemed an option, and it meant that they were really some of the very first of the Christian reformers to want to separate church and state. The Amish believed that the group called the Mennonites, who were followers of a former priest by the name of Menno Simons, that the Amish broke away believing that the Mennonites had not been strict enough in their discipline to keep the church separate from the world. But they do have the same original origin and many of the same beliefs and some of the same practices.
Can you tell us about, in the book, you know, a lot of it is describing how you grew up, of course, and how you discover that glittering world. At what point did you start to think or realize not everybody lives the way that we do? And how did you feel about that? Was that uncomfortable at all?
Well, my first 6 years I describe as having been a kind of magical childhood. Those years were devoted to family life on the farm and going to church and occasionally going to town. We didn't have a television set, and so I didn't have that much contact with anybody who wasn't Mennonite. But like a fish in the sea, I didn't know that being Mennonite was different. I just thought it was the way people were.
Right.
I thought, this is human. This is the way everyone is. Then I went to school, and that was my first awakening into difference, into feeling different from my classmates, and into recognizing that American pop culture had already in the 1950s made a huge difference in the lives of children, in the lives of other children, that is, because they would spend their time on the playground enacting everything from commercials to scenes from the television that they had watched the night before. And so those would be examples of things that would happen that would remind me that what we did and how we lived was different from the majority.
There's this section in the book where you talk about yourself as a little girl in school, and it was almost difficult for me to read. My heart went out to you. You were trying very hard. You had an answer to a question. It was a eureka moment for you. And something happened that the message that you ended up learning was not to try so hard, not to want things so much, and that you described this episode in the book as it made you feel smaller. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. One day, second grade, I think it was, we went to class, and the teacher, for some reason, had decided to make a challenge and put a, what is it, six-letter word on the board, and was a word that none of us had ever encountered in any of our reading. I think she was probably trying to teach us phonics, how to deduce words from putting parts of other words together. And the word was M-A-N-U-R-E. I looked at that and tried to decipher it. Thought first it might be manual. I went back to look at that word in the back of the room. That wasn't that. Kept on trying to figure it out just from the different sounds. Finally changed that U sound to a long U, and all of a sudden it was there. And I blurted out, manure. And the whole class, you know, jumped, and the teacher, much to my surprise, instead of being delighted that I had pieced together the sounds to in order to find the correct word, was very upset with me and put scotch tape or masking tape on my mouth and made me sit at a desk close to hers for the next part of the afternoon.
That's awful, Shirley. That brought tears to my eyes when I read that.
Oh, well, it brought tears to mine, too.
I bet.
And it was more than tears outwardly. What it really struck was a chord inside myself that, like you said, the message was not to care so much, not to try so hard, not to
excel.
Try to be big, which was the thing that I begin my book with, the desire to be big. And of course, the teacher was just teaching me a valuable lesson about not blurting out, not spoiling other people's
well, how gracious
own
of you.
discoveries. But nevertheless, it was a good reminder of the tension that I was going to experience, not only in school, but later on in life.
And that little girl grew up to be the president of Goshen College. That's an interesting journey from there to there.
It was a long journey, and one I could never have imagined when I was that little girl in second grade. But it was a series of steps that actually, most of which took place after the book is ended. The book is a childhood memoir, and the many steps of the later life were all rooted there in childhood. But the biggest decision was to go to college in the first place.
Why was that a big decision?
Because I was the first person on both sides of my family to do that. And we had been in this country for 10 generations, and the understanding that most Mennonite children grew up with was that farming was the best way of life, and the usual script for living your life would be to date at the end of high school, save some money, get married by late teens, early 20s, and start raising a family, preferably on a farm.
Yet, kind of the flip side of that coin is that what I found quite wonderful reading about the Mennonite community was that in that community, kind of the idea of it takes a village to raise a child, that a child isn't just the responsibility of the parents, but everybody's responsibility.
Right.
And that child is welcome not just to run home for that hug, but most anywhere. Can you talk a little bit more about that community sense.
One of the things that struck me as I reviewed my childhood, I was reviewing it through the lens of both my own experiences in higher education as well as my experience at working at the Fetzer Institute there in Kalamazoo.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most memorable statements I heard when I was listening to the Dalai Lama speak through my work at Fetzer,
mm-hmm.
was that my religion is kindness, said the Dalai Lama.
Mm.
And I began to think about my own childhood and the ways in which the richness of that experience of being surrounded by people who knew me, who loved me, who would possibly discipline me if I went out of bounds, but most certainly would be there for me if I needed them and would joke with me, ask me about my life, consider it that my life and their life were woven together, their lives and my life were woven together. And all of that took place at an unconscious level.
Hmm.
But now, looking back, I can see amazing strength in that community, and it gives me great gratitude in this season of gratitude to think about that kind of village raising me as a child, raising other children.
Yeah, absolutely wonderful. On the other hand, it was interesting that in that culture, you're encouraged toward plainness. And on the other hand, you have this car culture that's quite
yes.
amusing. Can you talk about that?
Well, I'm not sure how to what extent that still exists. Of course, Lancaster County is still a more rural part of the world than most places. This is Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
But during the time that I was entering my teen years, it was very common for young men, particularly young men who were working on their father's farms, to have very, what today would be called muscle cars, very fancy cars, high horsepower, gleaming bodies, lots of chrome, often with things like white cars with red interiors, or occasionally convertibles. Mostly, though, the thing that they cared most about, seemingly, was how fast the car could go and how powerful it sounded when you revved the engine. And so they had late model cars that were had much more power than any young person really needs. But of course, they enjoyed it. The idea of having a fancy car actually was part of the economics of the time.
How's that?
Because a lot of these young men did not get paid weekly wages, but they were incentivized by being told that when they got to be 16 or some date, they would have the opportunity to get a new car.
So there's this phrase, or maybe not a phrase, but this concept of seven sins, seven sweets, seven sours that I thought was fascinating. What's that all about?
Well, seven sweets and seven sours could very well be a marketing line for all of those Pennsylvania Dutch restaurants that line the major Lincoln Highway that goes through Lancaster County. Because many of those restaurants focus on quantity of food as well as quality of food, and on the idea that a Pennsylvania Dutch meal, and of course this doesn't refer to Dutch as in Holland Dutch, but Pennsylvania Deutsch, which is a form of German. So sometimes people get confused by that, but the cuisine is actually from Switzerland and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And it is heavy, as you might expect farm cuisine to be, because you have to stoke those engines as they go out to work. but it also focuses on variety. So you have many sweets, i.e. desserts, and many sours. I actually did a little research on that, on why this kind of cuisine arose, which I found interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to do as much with the meat that was the prime meat, which was pork. And pork, being a fatty meat, was considered important to have something that cuts the fat. So what cuts fat? Well, vinegar cuts fat. And so a lot of dishes with vinegar in them meant that you have coleslaw and pickled beets and pickled eggs and lots of pickled things to go as side dishes or condiments to a true Pennsylvania Dutch feast.
Mm-hmm. Now, there seems to be a fascination these days with quote-unquote plain people, whether it's the Mennonites or the Amish or maybe just a simplicity in life. I've seen a lot of books lately in bookstores about decluttering, about minimizing what you need to live. How do you look at that as a Mennonite? Because you are still an active member of that community, aren't you?
I am. And many of us who grew up plain and are no longer plain on the outside are searching for ways to be plain on the inside and also to live a lifestyle that is still congruent with what we believe to be the values we were taught when we were children.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those values certainly is to minimize, despite the cars, to minimize materialism.
Mm-hmm.
And to not be focused on consumer items as identity items, but rather to focus on the spiritual life. That often means for contemporary Mennonites, it means things like Simply in Season cookbook or Living More with Less. These were important books for Mennonites in the last several decades as ways of being part of, what you might call a simplicity movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that many others in the culture crave simplicity, as I certainly do myself. And I am grateful for the ways in which my childhood and my community among Mennonites over the course of my life has prepared me to try to focus on what's most important and to leave the rest behind.
It's like the rest of us are catching up to where you were from the beginning.
Well, I don't know about that, but I can say that it would be my goal to live a simple life.
Yeah.
And there is something like simplicity that's on the yonder side of complexity, which is, when I first read that, I think it's an Oliver Wendell Holmes quote, really, really resonated with me, because I'm not living the simple life of my childhood. I have gone through a PhD and many other life experiences that took me out into the world, but I hope and I seek a simplicity that's on the other side, that examines life in all of its complexity and says, there's something beautiful about naivete, and I choose to be simple, naive, plain, but mm-hmm. I do so on my own terms, having known complexity.
Yeah, yeah. There is a charming story that you've included in your memoir about, and it seems your mother wanted to be a writer too, and her story that she shared with her children is called The Magic Elevator. Maybe you can give us just a synopsis of what this wonderful story is and how it might have affected your life, and do you tell it to your children?
Sure. Well, the magic elevator arose because my mother had an assignment in the 12th grade in high school. She began to tell a story about two children who go out into the woods, find a hollow tree, discover that it has a little key and buttons in the tree. They go up, 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 up into the sky, out beyond the known universe. And there the elevator finally stops. They get out and they look around and they are on a cloud. They're in a sea of white, little puffy, cottony, wispy cloud. And a little man comes up, introduces himself, and he is no bigger than a raindrop. And he explains that they are at a rain factory and that he's going to explain to them how it works. He shows them all of these people. Of course, this is before computers, so they're sitting there with all their different bells and whistles, making it rain in different parts of the world. The children are excited. They want to learn more about how this works. They ask questions, but it's soon time to go home. And so they go back to the elevator and they look for their little gold key. And they can't find it. And they are upset. The little man is no longer with them. They don't have any recourse until finally one of the children says, I know how we'll get home. She goes back to the rain factory and has it rain and has it sunshine at the same time. A great rainbow develops, and the two children slide back home right into their mother's backyard.
That's
And
wonderful.
that's the story.
Do you tell it to your children too when they were small, or?
Yes, indeed. And my mother, who is still living and is going to be 87 years old in February,
Wonderful.
she still tells it to her children and her grandchildren and to her great-grandchildren.
Oh, that's wonderful. Why did you decide to write this memoir, Shirley? What was it that drove you to that?
Well, there were a lot of things. Certainly, like many other people who reach their 60s, I began to think about legacy, think about what it is that I wanted to say, what stories I wanted to tell and leave behind. So that impulse, which I share with many memoirists of my age, was to review my life and to find those things which children, grandchildren, and others who would have any reason to care would be able to know more about not only who I was, but what shaped me, what values I'd like to leave behind. I also became a student of the genre, and somebody who taught English for many years. I love stories. I love literature. And I began to really enjoy reading memoir. I read Frank McCourt's Angela's Ashes and Annie Dillard and Anne Lamott and Mary Carr. I could go on and on. In fact, I read a book that said if you want to write a memoir, best thing you can do is read 100 examples of the best memoirs, and that will become your little MFA program, your education. So I did that. I've read at least 100 other memoirs, and that took me to blogging. And from blogging and memoir reading and this legacy impulse, I thought, I would like to try memoir writing. And then I do have to give credit to the Kalamazoo Gazette, and to the Literary Awards program right there in Kalamazoo for the stimulus it gave me, because just at the time I was thinking of doing writing, along comes the opportunity to enter this contest, which took me to the Gilchrist Retreat Center, which was a Fetzer Institute property, and it gave me a reason to go on a silent retreat where for 3 days I talked to no one else but sat and wrote, watched the fire in my little cabin, took walks, and wrote memories. And when I won the essay contest in my category of adult memoir, that was one of those signs that I should continue. And for the next 2 years, I continued writing essays for the contest and in both cases won other awards. And that was enough to send me on my way.
Well, that's a wonderful story in itself. I have to tell you, though, Shirley, when I got to the end of the book, I was disappointed. I want part two. So I hope that you take another trip to Gilchrist and another 3 days to get started. And we'll see if we can keep you encouraged. But I would love to hear more about your journey on becoming a president at Goshen or your work at Fetzer Institute. So don't stop now.
Thank you.
Don't stop now.
Thank you. A number of people have said that they would like to know what round two looks like. So
exactly.
We'll see.
Yeah. Well, thank you for talking with us, Shirley. It's the book is called Blush, and it's a very enjoyable book. So thank you for talking to us about it.